This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Osea. Want truly hydrated skin? Meet Osea's body care breakthrough Hyaluronic Body Serum. It's designed to increase hydration by 161%. It's lightweight, fast-absorbing, and delivers 24 hours of hydration for silky smooth skin without any sticky afterfeel. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code SUMMER.
Hey, I'm Ellen from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hey, I'm Cody from Edmonton, Alberta.
I'm Eric from Nashville.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. When I talked to the metal legend Lemmy, he had to take a call halfway through our interview.
Excuse. Cut. Pause. Who's this now? Yes. Oh, I'm fine. Could you call me back in about 20 minutes? I'm in an interview. Okay, thanks. So many women, so little time.
It's Bullseye. Who is Lemmy? Well, he's the singer for Motorhead, and he's revered by metalheads around the globe. Here's a scene in the movie Airheads with Brendan Fraser and Steve Buscemi that pretty much sums it up.
Who'd win in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God?
Lemmy.
God.
Wrong, head. Trick question. Lemmy is God.
I talked to Lemmy in person a couple years ago at South by Southwest. You'll hear that amazing conversation later in the show. But first, Arrested Development isn't the only comedy show with a legion of passionate fans who obsess over series continuity, in-jokes, and daddy issues that's coming back after a years-long hiatus. There's also The Venture Brothers. It's Adult Swim's beloved parody of 1960s adventure cartoons. We'll revisit my conversation with the show's co-creator, Jackson Publick.
As soon as I had come up with it, I realized that every stray superhero and spy and you know, ninja idea I had could also fit under this umbrella.
It's true. There's a character named Dr. Girlfriend. Plus, a couple of Jason Kottke's all-time picks for the best stuff on the web. And the hosts of My Brother and Me offer up answers to listeners' pop culture quandaries. That's all this week on Bullseye. Let's go. My guest's birth name is Chris McCullough, but he's known in entertainment circles by the name Jackson Publick. In the 1990s, he was a writer and artist on the animated series The Tick. In the early 2000s, he created The Venture Brothers with his collaborator Doc Hammer. It's an animated series that's both a satire of and an homage to early adventure shows like Johnny Quest. It stars two sweet and stupid teen brothers, their mad doctor father and their tough guy bodyguard. The fourth season of the show ended in 2010, and after just a bit of a wait, the fifth season of the show debuted earlier this month. Here's a clip from the first episode of the new season. Dr. Thaddeus Venture explains his outer space project to a group of newly recruited college students. One of his sons, Hank Venture, grabs the mic, too.
All right, those of you in white clean suits are development class. Those in orange are manufacturing class. And all of you in green, you're in special class. There's nothing funny about special class. They are my personal helpers. And that makes them better than the rest of you.
Yeah, I'd just like to chime in here to say that all classes, colors, and creeds are special at Hanko. Think of Hanko as not just me, Hank Co., but as your company store. We have magazines, both dirty and clean, clothing, clean only, and of course, all your food stuff beats.
All
Thank
right,
you.
All right. We've got a lot of work ahead of us, fellow men and fellow women.
Jackson Publick and I spoke in 2007. I was, at the time, recording the show in my spare bedroom.
So this show, The Venture Brothers, is clearly born of the television program Johnny Quest in a certain way.
Right.
To what extent is it born of that, and to what extent did it come from something else, and you brought that into it?
I mean, initially, to a huge extent, it was borrowed and begged and stolen from Johnny Quest. I think when I started messing around with the characters, I was goofing more on like the Hardy Boys kind of stuff, just idiot kids. And I was thinking of like Scooby-Doo and stuff like that. And the initial ideas for it when I was going to do it as like a comic strip were just, you know, boy adventurers. And what would really happen is their throats would get cut or whatever. So, and I was reading a lot of Tom Swift.
I was going to say, people are always saying, are always saying Hardy Boys and what's it called? Johnny Appleseed, Johnny Quest. And the thing that I thought of was, I was like, you know what this is like? This is like Tom Swift and his flying lab.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which I only encountered when I was in my mid-20s or whatever. Somebody that I wrote with had a bunch of them from his childhood, and he lent them to me. And I was like, this is what Johnny Quest was ripping off, you know? So when I started messing around with the characters, it was just the boys. And then I started giving them a dad, and that just, you know, immediately led to Johnny Quest. So, I mean, the model is definitely Johnny Quest, but the inspiration was probably the stuff that inspired Johnny Quest in the first place.
I was going to say, one of the interesting things about it is that Johnny Quest, in a lot of ways, was sort of a last hurrah for that genre. Which had like a huge...
What genre though? Like that's what attracts me to Johnny Quest is that it kind of invented a genre, and that's why I like doing this show, because as soon as I had come up with it, I realized that every stray superhero and spy and you know ninja idea I had could also fit under this umbrella. Like there seems to be a non-existent like science action genre from the 60s that nobody's done anything with.
Well, there's this kind of boy adventurer thing that your show draws on very much. But it also brings in a lot of other sort of ideas and things from other sort of pop cultural detritus.
Yeah.
How do you make something that is like that, that has that quality of, you know, maybe pastiche or something like that, where it's bringing in all of these different odd things, which in a certain way is like one of the motivating factors of a lot of Adult Swim programming. Mm-hmm. And how do you take that and then invest it with something that's actually real? Because I think one of the things that people would say, that I would say distinguishes your show from some of the other shows that are like it, is that there's actually a little bit of sincere interest in the characters and their emotional lives, no matter how ridiculous they are.
Just because that's what I'm drawn to writing. You know, I think definitely when I started the pilot, I meant for it to be more superficial than it ended up being. And, you know, Doc Hammer, my, you know, co-writer is, he deserves a lot of the credit for, you know, kind of pushing things. Because even when I was going to do the pilot, I was going to do this super cheap, make it look bad on purpose, like the old Marvel cartoons of the 60s, like worse than, Johnny Quest actually looked pretty cool sometimes. It was limited, but, and even as I was kind of pitching it that way, I already felt like that was an old joke or that was limiting or whatever. And, I guess at the time you had the, you know, like the ambiguously gay duo and stuff like that, that were kind of making that joke. So, once I gave up on the style being so, you know, lame on purpose, I thought, well, I should make this actually good. And I had written for The Tick and stuff for years, which had like a definite heart to it, you know, even though it was superhero parody and everything. So it's just, I don't know, once you start digging around in these characters, like you kind of can't help it. Like I'm naturally more into storytelling than just quick jokes and being ironic all the time and everything, you know.
There are kind of direct parodies in the show sometimes, and there are sort of pop cultural allusions that aren't much more than just pop cultural allusions sometimes.
Yeah.
Are there things that happen like that, ideas that you think of that are like that, that you discard because they're too much, they're too empty, or they're not character driven?
Probably. I mean, I think, because I'm really sensitive to that in other shows that I won't name. But like, you know, just a...
That Robot Chicken show?
No. shows where, and it, maybe it's a thing that my generation is specifically guilty of, movies or shows where simply referencing something from your childhood...
A Family
is,
Guy.
replaces writing or making a joke.
Dane
you
Cook.
Know? I've actually never seen Dane Cook. All I hear about is... Yeah, like every comedian that gets interviewed now bitches about him, but I've never seen him. But yeah, I'm really sensitive to that. Like where you go, oh, you know, just mentioning Raiders of the Lost Ark doesn't make that writing or comedy or anything like that. And I'm sure we do it to some extent ourselves, but I like to think it's the character's fault. That if a character just mentions something, I mean, we either treat it, you know, I either treat it as a story point or a kind of what if kind of thing. Like, you know, I took the Fantastic Four and screwed with them because they always fascinated me. And I thought, well, wouldn't it actually be horrible to get bathed in cosmic rays and have all these afflictions instead of superpowers? And that was kind of how I approached a lot of the more, parodistic, is that a word? Parodistic elements of of the first season in particular was going, all right, you know, take this thing you loved when you were a kid or that fascinated you or that you maybe wished you would grow up and write for one day, because I definitely wanted to write comics when I was a kid, and make it, warp it with disappointment and failure, because that's, you know, that's what the Venture Brothers is all about.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Jackson Publick. He's one of the creators of The Venture Brothers, which runs on Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network. He and I spoke in 2007. The Venture Brothers just returned for its fifth season. Here's a clip from the first episode of this new season. Dean Venture is talking to his new crush. She's a mutant and can speak to him telepathically. Dean struggles to respond in the same fashion. One word of warning. This clip uses a word that teenage boys often used to refer to a lady's chest. Just FYI.
Just come, be with me in Eden, and challenge Martin for leadership.
How did you do that? You talked to my brain!
You can do it too. Just try and think your words into my brain.
She's gonna kiss me. I used to want to kiss the girl Gremlin with the lipstick. Talia's taller and has boobies.
No, okay. Just concentrate.
Triana had boobs. I wonder if all boobs are soft, or are some super extra soft.
Dean, what you're not doing is concentrating. You cannot let your mind wander.
Do I just touch them, or should I ask? I really hope they haven't gotten all mutated, but what if they drip acid now?
All right, never mind. Let's just talk regular.
Explain what you mean when you say that the show is about, what was it, failure and sadness?
Yeah.
Disappointment and unsuccess.
It's disappointment and failure. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I realized early on it wasn't a modern, subversive take on Johnny Quest in that, like, the boys are not Johnny Quest. Like, the real story is that Dr. Venture was once Johnny Quest and has now grown up, you know, he was raised in the space race, jet age, you know, neo-futurism kind of era, and has grown into just a miserable, bald, pill-chewing, you know, which I think the whole country has kind of done. So, I mean, I'm really drawn to that period. I love the 60s and, you know, design and architecture and the culture, and I love the space race and stuff, and how much futurism was going on then that we seem to have dropped the ball on now that we've arrived in the 2000s.
In a way, it's kind of like connecting. The disappointment is almost generational. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say it. The generation that followed is crappier. It's more like all those dreams. Those bubbles burst. Those dreams died for whatever reason, probably in large part due to the actions of that previous generation. You know, Watergate probably burst that bubble a little bit.
One of the things that struck me was the way that this show has a very odd reflection and often kind of a comment on the world of action, boys action adventure and comic books and their weird relationship with women.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way that the boys live in this womenless world, this motherless world with this father slash non-father and this non-father slash father.
Yeah.
And they're all
this giant murdering muscle-bound mommy that they have in the form of Brock.
Exactly. And it's like, and it's it seems like in a way, kind of a way of addressing the adolescent issues that these adolescent characters should have, you know, but kind of have weird versions of in comic book world and adventure world.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something I've always kept in mind is the lack of women in their world. And in our world, in the Venture Brothers world, it definitely has a negative effect on everybody. You know, it's not like, hey, boys club. It's we don't know how to feel. They're, you know, they don't know how to emotionally respond to each other. And, you know, all the women are either femme fatales or literally whores. Brock will run into some hookers from time to time.
Oh, you also have a character who's a woman who speaks with a man's voice.
Yeah. Who's becoming like the only genuine woman in the show and becoming a more fully rounded person instead of just, oh, we need a woman here.
I mean, have you ever thought about that in terms of not only the kind of fictional worlds of adventures and comic books, but also the real life worlds of adolescents, and especially the kind of adolescents who are into adventures and comic books and other things that might be called nerdy?
Absolutely. Yes. which includes me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and everything I both love and hate about myself as I grow older and seem to remain an adolescent. Probably made the show up when I was single.
Uh-huh.
If that tells you anything. But it's all adolescent male fantasies. It's the dark side of all of that. It's the sad truth of all that. And just like it's the sad truth of the broken dreams of the space race, you know, it's, oh, we really did it to just be in competition with the Russians. And, oh, we're not really a boys club. There's just no girls that'll talk to us. You know, no girls allowed because they don't want to be here. And also, I mean, just in terms of the blueprint that I was following, Johnny Quest's mother did.
Just not
interesting. Fun fact: my mother also did. So it's fun for me to mess around in my own subconscious about all that too.
Can you
not to get too deep?
I mean, not to get too deep, but is there? Was there like any examples that you can give of how your own experience informed what you're doing here?
Probably gave me a darker sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
As I was growing up. Yeah, because she also died right when I was at that prime boy adventure age. I was like 10. And I definitely retreated into comic books and movies and stuff after that. I mean, I was a real comic geek in my teenage years, and I worked in a comic shop, and all I wanted to do for a living was draw Spider-Man. And so I went to a cartooning school after that. So now that I look back on it, all definitely probably a response to that, especially because I had, you know, kind of revolving door situation with the step families, and my father remarried a couple of times. So I just went in my room and read comic books and got chubby.
Chris McCullough, also known as Jackson Publick, is one of the creators of the Venture Brothers. We spoke in 2007. The show's fifth season is airing now on Adult Swim, Sundays at midnight. The first four are available on DVD and from Netflix. After a break, Jason Kottke of Kottke.org tells you some of his favorite things of all time you can waste your time on the internet. And the hosts of My Brother and Me offer up answers to listeners' pop culture quandaries. Oh, and also Lemmy from Motorhead. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is supported by MailChimp, building technology for people and businesses around the world to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. MailChimp, email marketing for everyone.
Hey, gang. You can subscribe to the Bullseye podcast at MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The three brothers McElroy host the MaximumFun.org advice podcast, My Brother and Me. And from time to time, they join us here on Bullseye to help solve some pop culture quandaries sent in by our audience. Justin, Travis, Griffin, how are you?
Doing great.
Good.
Happy
how are you?
Here.
We have some just absolutely tremendous questions that need your expert or, frankly, inexpert guidance. Why don't we get straight to them? Here's a question from Katie. She's wondering about movie and concert posters. Are they acceptable to put on the walls of an adult's apartment or house? Sub-question, what if they're framed?
I would say, as a man who once had an Ace Ventura When Nature Calls poster on his wall, not movie posters.
Not a goof. Not a goof. For radio, I still have a Tombstone poster hanging up in my wife's office because it helps her to think. That's not a joke either. But that's a great movie. What if you have a poster for a bad movie and you didn't know? That's the worry that you run into. Oh, comic book posters are straight out, by the way. If you have a picture of a super team, I don't care who drew it. Get it off of there.
You say that, and I'm staring at my Superman poster.
No, oh, but it's Alex Ross.
It is. It's beautifully
okay because
done.
Because it's Alex Ross.
It's artwork.
I think that the poster maybe has to be from a movie that came out before you were born. It has to be an original poster, not a reproduction, and it should probably be in a foreign language.
Yeah. That all those are great criteria. I would also suggest that it not have been made in Photoshop. It had to be if it was drawn by a real ass man or woman, then it's a lot more acceptable, I think.
And don't use poster sticky tack because it stains the walls.
There's no there's no poster that can go up on your walls as an adult without a frame, right?
Gotta frame it.
Definitely not.
Can you put posters on outside walls just to like let people know that like you are coming into a Doug Flutie enthusiast?
Abandon all non-Flutie, ye who enter here.
Well, what you have to do is when you put on a movie in your house, you have to put up a now showing marquee outside.
Oh, that's great.
With each passing idea, this is sounding less and less like the home of an actual person and more like an episode of a show on HGTV. Maybe something
that's
where
just called,
the...
This show's just called Help!
I did it wrong.
Here's a question from a user on our forum who goes by Concrete Tales. He is wondering whether he can tell his now 4-year-old daughter that the shows that she likes, especially Dora the Explorer and Thomas the Tank Engine, are awful.
They actually rebooted it. They rebooted Thomas. Now he's just Thomas the Tank. And it's a way cooler show.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. It's your fault, dummy. You think the 4-year-old is like calling the cable company and subscribing to these channels and buying DVDs off of Amazon? Stop giving him bad things. At this point, you've lost him. He's closer to Dora and Thomas the Tank Engine than he is to you.
When your daughter's like, hey, I want to watch Dora, I want you to say, ooh, instead, let's watch Downton Abbey.
Yeah, your 4-year-old's going to love that.
It's time to grow up.
At this point, if you try to take Thomas the Tank Engine away from your baby, they'll put you in a home. Baby, at the rate adults are going, you're going to start getting put into adult care facilities at around 50. And your child will put you there if you try to take Thomas away from her or him.
I would say you're probably better off just pretending like they never existed.
Oh, that's great.
That's good.
Break the DVDs and be like, what? Dora the what? A talking train? What are you talking about?
Won't they be traumatized by you trampling all over the line between fantasy and reality, sort of like me when I watched Return to Oz?
You were the kid that had to hide behind the couch whenever TikTok came on the screen, weren't you?
Oh, man, I was so afraid of TikTok.
Like a fat metal genie. I hate that guy.
I was afraid of everything in that entire movie. Why did I watch it?
It's a horrifying movie. When I was a child, I was afraid of the HBO logo they would show before movies.
Absolutely true.
That's 100% true. I was terrified of it.
And the robotic woman from Superman 3.
Here's a question from one of our forum users. His name is Dandy Fellow. I presume that's not his legal name. That's the name he uses on the forum. Is it in good taste to approach a stranger because of a book they're reading or a band that they're wearing the shirt of or any other sort of public consumption of a thing that you like and support?
The t-shirt, yes.
That's what they're inviting with the t-shirt. They're hoping that they're showing their support. They're flying that flag. They're hoping that someone will come to them and strike up a conversation.
The book, though, that's their time, you know, like, hey, I'm enjoying this thing and relaxing with it, and now you've come over and stopped me from doing that.
If you ask someone about the book they're reading, what you are saying to them is, I forgot to bring something. I did it wrong, so now entertain me. That's all. I didn't get a book so I could hopefully strike up a conversation with some people.
Who's handing out books?
I was in St. Louis when they was handing out books in Chicago.
I was trying out some of that Red Snapper in the dinner cart. Oh, boy. That's better than you can get back home.
Something that irks me for reasons beyond my comprehension is when people say, oh, yeah, I read that. Like, strangers say this to me. Like, I was on a plane reading Game of Thrones and they said, oh, I just finished that. As if they're just bragging. We get it, man. You're literate.
Got would it be better if he was like, I've never read that. I can't read.
That make you feel good?
Nobody says that in the tone like, oh, let's start a book club. They always say it like, this book was a race and you lost.
Justin Griffin and Travis McElroy are the hosts of the advice podcast, My Brother, and Me, which you can find for free in iTunes, Zune, or whatever podcasting software you'd like to use, or online at MaximumFun.org. Gentlemen, thank you once again for joining us on Bullseye.
Thank you. I hope we helped.
Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by our favorite critics to recommend bits and pieces of culture that are worth your time. This week, we're joined by weblink maestro Jason Kottke from Kottke.org. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Jesse. How you doing?
I'm excited to talk about your all-time picks here for internet. First of all, this is the most amazing thing that the internet has to offer, as far as I'm concerned. Information on the topic of sending children through the mail. I couldn't even make it through saying it. How do you even find out about sending children through the mail, Jason?
I saw a picture. It's a photo from 1900, and it's a mail carrier posing with a young boy in his delivery bag. And it's from the Smithsonian. It was on Flickr Commons, which is a program that Flickr has where museums and other public institutions can upload their photo collections, which is fantastic. It's like there's stuff from Smithsonian and NASA, the National Archives, Brooklyn Museum, all sorts of different stuff.
Okay, so was sending children through the mail ever an actual thing?
Apparently so. The post office introduced their parcel post service in 1913, which is like basically you can send stuff that's bigger than a letter through the mail. And this was a great thing for people in the U.S. who were living in rural areas because they could get all sorts of stuff shipped to them for the first time, like live animals and stuff. Like live animals that didn't need feeding in transit were fine to ship. And so I think people thought, like, well, you know, if I can send like chickens through the mail, like, why can't I send kids through the mail?
There's so many reasons.
Well, And yeah, so according to the Smithsonian, there were a couple of kids that were sent by mail before the Postmaster General put his foot down and stopped it.
Okay, let's talk about one of the great internet phenomena, which is arguing over a weird theoretical physics question. And your post about Cecil Adams of The Straight Dope, the famous question-answering alternative newspaper column, trying to answer the question, an airplane taxis in one direction on a moving conveyor belt going the opposite direction at the same speed. Can the plane take off? Now, what did you learn when you delved, I'm sure, far too deep into this question about something that will never happen?
I learned that a lot of people think it will take off, and that there are other people who will swear up and down, even people who have, you know, who have, you know, physics degrees, science knowledge, background, you know, they insist that the plane will not be able to take off.
Do you think this is a worthy Kickstarter project?
Well, it's funny because Mythbusters, a few years ago, they aired a program on this question. They had a truck pulling a tarp, basically, that was, I don't know, it was a couple thousand feet long. And then they had an ultralight take off. You know, basically, they had the truck pull the tarp one way and the ultralight was going the other way.
An ultralight, that's like a one of those super skinny airplanes.
Yeah, it's like a one-seater. It's an ultralight airplane. It's a very light airplane, I guess. You know, they had the plane try to take off, which of course it did.
Wow. Physics is amazing, and so is the internet.
It is.
Jason Kotke's post about whether a plane can take off if it's going exactly the same speed forward as a conveyor belt that it's standing on top of is going backwards is on his website at Kotke.org, as well as his post about sending children through the mail. You can find links to both on the Bullseye page on our site, MaximumFun.org. Jason Kotke from Kotke.org, thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you, Jesse.
After the break, I'll talk to Motorhead's Lemmy about bridging the gap between punk and metal. If you don't know who Lemmy is, just imagine a rock and roll frontman who has his own tank and drives it around, and that seems appropriate somehow. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Happy summer, everybody. Griffin McElroy here, the youngest of the McElroy brothers.
I'm Travis McElroy, the middlest brother.
And I'm beloved performer Jimmy Buffett.
He is not. But we do a podcast together called My Brother and My Brother and Me. It's a comedy advice show. You can find it at mbmbam.com, MaximumFun.org, or just search for it on iTunes.
I love you, Sacramento!
You're not even on a stage.
Griffin, are you watching the shrimp? They're beginning to boil.
So join us this summer as we waste an hour of your life that you'll never get back ever again.
You know, I know something about wasting away again in Margaritaville. I'm beloved.
I know you are.
It's summer now, and come September, you're going to wish you had stretched it out just a little bit longer. So, get planning. Hop on a boat with Mark Maron, Eugene Merman, Cameron Esposito, Dan Deacon, John Roderick, John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats, and a ton of other great comedians and musicians. And we've got a new addition to the lineup, Wyatt Cenac. It's the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival, September 13th through 16th. Set sail from Miami into the Bahamas for music, comedy, and of course, shuffleboard. Tickets available now at boatparty.biz, a real website for a real event. The Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival is sponsored by Splitsider.com, KCRW, and MailChimp. I'll see you in the high seas. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Lemmy is an icon of metal. He was born Ian Fraser Kilmister in 1945, and he grew up surrounded by rock and roll. He learned to play guitar playing along with Beatles records as a teenager, got a gig hauling gear for Jimi Hendrix in the late 1960s, and in the early 70s joined the psychedelic space rock band Hawkwind. Lemmy got kicked out of Hawkwind, probably for being more into doing speed than dropping acid. But maybe that was for the best. He went on to form one of the most important bands in metal and punk music, Motorhead. Here's one of Motorhead's most beloved records, 1980's The Ace of Spades. Lemmy and I spoke in 2010 at Stubbs Barbecue in Austin, Texas, just hours before Motorhead was set to perform there. He was in town for South by Southwest, talking about a documentary made about his life called Lemmy. It's available now on DVD and Blu-ray.
Lemmy was at the beginning of heavy metal, you know, maybe even pre-Black Sabbath.
Without Lemmy, there'd be like Motorhead, there'd be no Metallica, no Megadeth, no Slayer, nothing. There wouldn't be any of the heavy metal we have today.
There's no words to describe him, really. He's just the f***ing legend that is Lemmy. He's like God, you know?
Man's the modern Jesus. Yeah. But to be honest, he's f***ing Jesus Christ.
Rock and roll, he's Lemmy. Lemmy, he's rock and roll.
Fun fact, Lemmy doesn't do interviews before 1 p.m. because that's when he gets up. And when he gets up, he pours himself a stiff drink. I know, because I saw it in his hand.
Lemmy, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I was really touched in watching the film, Lemmy, about you last night, to see you talk about first encountering rock and roll in the 50s.
Right.
Do you remember what the first rock and roll records you heard were?
No, to be quite honest, I don't. It was probably a guy called Tommy Steele, who was an English rocker, you know, like, probably him. Or Bill Haley, probably. Rock Around the Clock, you know, one of those.
Rock and roll was this huge cultural turning point. What was significant about it to you as a kid? Like, what made it,
it was
make you...
mine, and nobody else liked it. My mum and dad hated it, so it was obviously good, you know.
Was it something that your peers were into, that your friends were into, or
yeah,
was it
well, a few of them, you know. It's weird, you know. Things go in cycles. I've seen the same thing happen about five times. But, you know, rock and roll is dead. No, it's not. You know, like, and so we come around to another different kind of rock and roll. Now there's the original. Then there was the Beatles. Then there was the San Francisco sound. Then there was like punk, you know. It always comes around again. We're waiting for another one right now. It should be a rejuvenation of it soon. It's not happened yet. People think it's already happened. It's not. There's going to be a new sensation first.
You're English, but you spent a lot of your adolescence in Wales.
Yeah.
Was that difficult for you? Was it weird to be the English kid?
Well, it taught me how to fight. And it also taught me the futility of fighting, because it doesn't matter how hard you are, there's always somebody harder. And it's all luck anyway, you know, so I just give it up after I got out of Wales. It's no point, you know. But, you know how kids are. When I first got there, I had to fight about the first 20 kids, you know, the top echelon, you know, see what I was made of, you know.
What was your record?
Oh, I lost a lot. I mean, you're surrounded by the enemy, you know. It's not your best environment for best foot forward, you know what I mean?
You were a teenager when you first saw the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
Well, tell me where and when.
What? Playing?
Yeah.
1960, I guess, or something like that. 59. I got my first guitar, I think. And then, I mean, we just played around the local, you know, births, marriages and deaths, you know, sort of thing. You don't get much funeral work, I'll give you that. But we play anyway, you know, just to play, like, you know, when you're a kid, you do that. Wouldn't do it now. Money up front, please.
Star. Hawkwind was the band that you were a member of in the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s.
71 I joined, 75 I got fired, yeah.
And Hawkwind were, as described in the movie, especially sort of an acid band.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't seem like an acid kind of guy, but no, maybe I'm mistaken. Were you then?
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, we used to take them like dolly mixes. I mean, they said acid didn't work 2 days in a row, but we found out if you double the dose, it did, you know. So that's what, I mean, the whole Hendrix tour was tripping. Everybody, the crew, you know, the older bands, everybody. I didn't know anybody who wasn't doing acid then, 67. It was just, that's how it was, you know. It was the same over here, too, you know.
How did it affect your sense of making art?
Well, I haven't done any for a long time, but it's really, I think it's a beneficial thing to have done it. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who did it and never came back, you know. There's somewhere in the basket weaving factory, you know, which is kind of unfortunate, but it did very well for me. It taught me a lot about myself, and it made me very self-aware. You know?
What did it teach you?
Oh, I don't know. You can't describe. It's just it changed my perspective on more or less everything. Because you're helpless in the face of an acid onslaught, you know. It just goes boom. You know? So you just have to grasp the mane and ride it out, you know. It's good. It takes all your control away, which is very good for some people.
I want to ask you a little bit about the aesthetics of your playing. You play the bass in a way that no one else does, except maybe people who are trying to sound like Lemmy from Motorhead.
Not many of them.
How did you come to... First of all, describe what the difference is for these public radio people
open
out
strings.
There.
It's like I play it like a sitar in a way. I have an open string, a drone string, and play the notes on the next one up, you know. So as long as it's an E or AOD, I can do that, you know. And I do a lot of chords, you know. So that's mainly what's different, because I'm a guitar player, turned bass player, you know.
When you started playing bass, what did you want out of the sound that you were making? What was your objective?
I wanted ear-splitting noise, actually. Preferably in tune, but, you know, if it's ear-splitting enough, that doesn't matter either. No, I just wanted to be in a band, you know, basically. I wanted to belong, you know. And Hawkwind was a great band, you know. I mean, I got up on stage, the guy said, "Who plays bass?" The bass player didn't show up, you know. It was a free show. And the guy says, "Who plays bass?" And my mate, who wanted me in the band to be his friend, said, "He does." I thought, bastard, you know, I never picked up a bass in my life, right? Never, even. And I got up there, and Nick Turner, the sax player, was really helpful. He came across and he said, "Make some noises in E. This is called You Shouldn't Do That." And walked away again. None of that old-fashioned stuff like two verses solo, you know, help you out. So, I mean, I must have done something right. I was with him 4.5 years, you know.
In terms of music, you got fired from Hawkwind.
Yeah, no, I got fired from every band I was in, actually. The only way I could stop being fired was to form my own band. You know, they can't find me out of this one. It's mine, you know.
When you formed your own band, did you have, like, a plan, a scheme? Was there something that you thought, well, this is my band, and
see,
it's going to be different in this
plans.
Way?
I wanted to be the MC5, basically, you know. Five piece of the singer, and I was just going to be the bass player. And, of course, then the singer leaves, you know, because he can't stand the guitarist or something, you know. And off it went, you know. So I got stuck with the singing. And it just worked out that way. Now I couldn't imagine being just a sideman behind a singer anymore. I could have then. In Hawkwind, I used to do the high harmonies, just backing vocals, you know.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with an icon of rock and roll, Lemmy. He bridged the gap between metal and punk with his band Motorhead. We spoke in 2010 at Stubbs Barbecue in Austin, Texas. A documentary about his life, also called Lemmy, premiered around the same time.
Well, the basic difference is that most bass players sound like this. Whereas I sound quite different. 1, 2, 3!
You play in Motorhead in this incredibly ferocious style. What inspired you to do that in a time when You know, even bands that were loud, like The Who, were not ferocious the way that Motorhead is.
Well, The Who were, actually. The Who were always ferocious because Townsend's nuts. And, like, Entwistle's nuts, you know. And Mooney was definitely nuts, you know. They were always pretty vicious, you know. But, like, I know what you mean, yeah. There's a lot of loud bands looking at their shoes, you know, while they're playing. That's not the way I do it, you know. You've got to let the audience know you're there, you know.
Was that something that you chose for yourself? Like, did you think, this is what I want to be?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you see a lot of bands, and I've seen a lot of bands. I saw the Beatles at the Cavern, you know, before they got a record deal. And I saw the Stones early on, too. And I saw The Who a lot. And I saw Hendrix, because I was working for him. And it just told me that you've got to stand out. You've got to be a different... You've got to look different, right? Because who wants a band that looks like them? Come and show up interchangeable with the audience. That's not show business. That's not very entertaining. You know, anybody can buy a bloody plaid shirt and a pair of jeans, you know. That's not the story. You know, you have to be special, I think. I always customize everything as soon as I get it, you know.
I was reading this interview that was with you, and it was from the mid-1980s, 1986 or something like that. And you were talking about, it was a metal magazine. You were talking to a metal dude, and he was talking about, you know, bands singing songs about, you know, riding lightning with the devil or...
No, we never wrote about the devil.
Yeah. So, no. But and your reaction to him talking about that was that you felt like it was... I think you said that it was felt like cheating or something like that.
Oh, well, it's too easy, isn't it? The devil, you know. Ooh, you know. And also people like Stryper who sang about the Lord, you know. I think it's all bollocks, all that. I don't need the Lord or I don't need the devil either. I'm responsible for what I do, you know. You know, you can hold me up in front of the great desk in the sky at the end of it all, and I'll be quite happy to put my hand up for my actions, you know.
You really opened up a lot for this documentary, sort of 3 years of your life.
Felt like five. Everywhere you go, another camera comes around the corner, you know.
What was it like? Did you have any? Did you have any reservations about trusting the story of you to someone else?
No, I got to see it before it went out, you know, so any glaring faux pas I got to kill, you know. But it was okay, you know. I mean, they did very well, I think.
Do you permit yourself time for that kind of self-reflection? Like, do you think back about what you've done and who you are?
Not much. It's with this game, you've got to be on top of the time, you know. You've got to be on top of where you are right now, you know. There's no room for... Well, we had this problem before, I recall. You know, that's not good to you. This is this time, not that time.
Something that I wondered as I was watching the movie was you've had such a singular life, like such a commitment to being this thing that you are.
This thing, yes, that's right.
You know?
That's right, yeah.
And I wonder if you ever imagine yourself... If you ever imagine yourself having lived a different life, if you ever think of...
Well, I could have been a convict. I'm not qualified for anything, you see. Anyway, I have no diplomas or anything. I didn't graduate, you know. So I was expelled, you know. That was my graduation present, you know. So this is one of the few things. There's this, boxing and evangelism, right? I don't fancy the other two. Too much punishment.
As I was watching the film, you know, I looked at the other guys from the Rockin' Vickers,
right.
your first band, and I don't know, maybe they're still touring as the Rockin' Vickers, but they didn't appear to be.
No, they're not now. No.
And I heard you talk about having to make a choice between being a rock and roll guy and having a family life.
Well, if you have a family life, that usually kills the rock and roll half of it.
Yeah.
Because you have to be at home, you know, with kids.
But
I never was married, you see. So.
But there are people who, you know, choose the family life over the rock life. And right. That's what I really wonder about, whether you've ever thought to yourself, maybe I should have done this differently and quit when I was 35.
Most marriages break up, you know, especially these days. I mean, I don't know any happily married couples, do you?
Oh, I'm pretty happy.
Well, yeah, you know, but that's on the radio, yeah. You know. I mean, we're not going to hear any secrets from you, right? But do you know any other happily married?
Hey, Lemmy, you don't know about the groupies I have to deal with.
Oh, I'm sure.
Just the road headaches.
Well, how do they know which one you are? You're on the radio.
My dulcet tones, friend. It seems like such a difficult life that you've chosen, the relentlessness of it, the touring and the...
It's a great life. I get to travel all around the world, sleep with women of all sizes, colors, and religious persuasions, and everybody there is happier than when I arrived. I mean, what better job is there than that?
What do you think your life would be like if you retired? What would you do with yourself?
Retired? I don't understand that. Why would you retire? What could possibly be better than this? You know, I haven't got any grandchildren to dandle on my knee and et cetera, you know, so I don't see why you would do that.
Well, Lemmy, it's so kind of you to take the time to talk to us. Thank you so much for being here.
See you again.
Lemmy plays bass and fronts the band Motorhead. We interviewed Lemmy in conjunction with a documentary about his life. It's available on video. It's called Lemmy. Every week on Bullseye, we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's the Outshot. Some records are about virtuosity. Jimi Hendrix rips out an amazing guitar part that blows your mind. Sometimes they're about feelings. Joni Mitchell taking you on an emotional journey. Sometimes it's power. AC/DC pushing you into the red. Sometimes the appeal of a record isn't about those clear things, though. Sometimes you just get swept up by a texture. Swept into a state of being. I bought Blowout Comb by the hip-hop group Diggable Planets when it came out in 1994. I was 13, and it was my favorite rap record almost from the opening fanfare. On most hip-hop albums, the beats come from a dozen different producers. Each one is an attempt to do two things. One, showcase an MC. And two, try for a hit. Blowout Comb is the opposite of that. Diggable Planets had a huge hit the year before with their album Reachin' that won them a Grammy and the single Rebirth of Slick, Cool Like That. You probably remember it. They were the digestible, friendly face of rap, the coffee shop alternative to scary gangsterism, which was the last thing that they wanted to be. Diggable Planets weren't gangsters, but they didn't want to give you a hug and share a chai either. Blowout Comb was a refutation of that image. It's an attempt to create a feeling, a state of mind. It's rich and full, and it's very dark. It's also explicitly revolutionary. The group was rescuing itself from the outside world and hoping to take their people with them. They said it simply in their first single from the album, the manifesto, Dial 7, Axioms of Creamy Spies. This is the season of our self-savior. Check it out. In the year of 89, I stepped back my black mind. Found peace that from the east I shine. One time blind, I refined and over time. I realized the dreamy spy gets the climb. Find the spot in this land of Uncle Sam. Focus my thoughts and be that true black man that I am. I stand in the face of oppression. With my sisters and my brothers, no slipping, no half-stepping. The proper nation is
my representation. I wear Timberland, study in Timbuktu. Won't rest until they free, brother Mumia Abu. Now can you feel it? Nothing can save you, for this is the season of our self-savior. Like Che Guevara, this young urban gorilla sparks the revolution. Black tactics, whatever.
We see what's happening.
The album draws in samples from all over the musical spectrum, but they're all in the service of a unified tone. It's urban and muggy and aesthetically almost perfectly coherent. None of the MCs were engaged in the skills-centric hip-hop culture of the time. No one's ripping the mic, dropping a crazy verse, dominating the competition. Instead, every one of the members of the group becomes an instrument in a dense ensemble of sound.
Fly clothes, cash flow, and crazy L's to spark.
It's crowded, plus they drinking my space, shouted because they chase. When I strut out, sift through my block, I'm cuckoo. Shift my mood to break, stole my mind back black. So what you play the board, skimmer? We got butter, so surfaces out. Clever, and I fix it for you. Funk time is moat time. Slackers hit the back. Blackers fit my pack, and we for whatever. We get down in this pleasure heavy, and we are measured by the 10 degrees of math. In a puzzle and locked, clocked in struggle. Can't keep it 3 foot, three above mat. And in so depth, I defect with my vanguard squad, the guards of Brooklyn.
Blowout Comb wasn't aggro and super lyrical enough for the people who came to love the similarly dusty sound of the Wu-Tang Clan. Maybe a year later. It didn't have the non-threatening hits that brought the group the Grammy for their first record. In fact, it was more or less the end of Digable Planet's career. Blowout Comb was a commercial failure, and they broke up within a year of the record coming out. When Digable Planets tried to communicate their cloistered Gramscian aesthetic to the world, they ended up alienating the people that they were trying to change. But that doesn't make Blowout Comb any less spectacular. That's my upshot.
Type slick, keep it moving when it's after dark. We live in Brooklyn, Brooklyn. We live in Brooklyn, Brooklyn. No lies, do or die in the land of showing food. The place where I dwell is where the warriors dwell. Too many stories to tell, so all the...
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer is Nick White. Our intern is Henry Malofsky. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Bullseye's theme music provided by the Go Team, thanks to them and their label, Memphis Industries. You can find this show and all of our past Bullseye shows absolutely 100% for free, downloadable, streamable, whatever, at MaximumFun.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast free in iTunes or wherever. Be sure to go to boatparty.biz if you'd like to join us for the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival. It's happening in September. And Mark McGrath, I'm sorry I ruined your Mark McGrath and Friends cruise. If you want to come on our cruise, you can come for free. Just email me, jesse@maximumfun.org. That's about it. Remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Whether you're planning a weekend away or an international adventure, All Trips annual travel insurance can protect every trip you take for the next 365 days. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This election season, you can expect to hear a lot of news, some of it meaningful, much of it not. Give the Up First podcast 15 minutes, sometimes a little less, and we'll help you sort it out, what's going on around the world and at home. Three stories, 15 minutes, Up First, every day. Listen every morning, wherever you get your podcasts.